Welcome, I'm your host, Jules DeVito, and you're listening to the Highly Sensitive Human Podcast, the show that offers an insight into the world of the highly sensitive person and helps those who identify with the traits of high sensitivity to feel more empowered and resilient without denying their authentic gifts. Welcome everyone, and I'm so excited to have Marina on the podcast today. So Marina specializes in alternative approaches to health and spirituality. She is originally from Yugoslavia and she spent her life traveling the globe, earning various certificates and collecting valuable life experiences. So Marina has a BA in psychology from the University of Novi Sad, Serbia. And her MA in communications is from the University of Hawaii, Honolulu. She trained in conflict resolution and mediation, yoga and meditation, and Ayurveda. She is a certified mindfulness-based addiction recovery coach, and she currently teaches this 8-week course online. Marina is also a certified practitioner of compassionate inquiry, developed by Dr. Gabor Mate, who is a world-renowned expert in developmental childhood trauma and its impact on physical and mental health. So her work is closely connected to her personal path of recovery and mental health and addiction. And throughout one of her dear teachers, she's learned that we teach others what we need to learn. And so her hope is to continue growing as well as teaching and assisting others in their personal transformation. So today we're going to be looking at the connection and the relationship between the highly sensitive person and those who suffer from addiction. And we're going to actually try and define what we mean by addiction. We'll talk and draw upon Gabor Mate's work, who is a huge inspiration of mine and Marina's as well. And we're going to be also talking about the compassionate inquiry, the 8-week mindfulness-based recovery program, and also something which both Marina and I relate to, which is this idea and this concept of the wounded healer and how we who step into this healing profession are working to guide others on their journey of healing and transformation have often been through our own struggles, trauma, and challenges, and that really is what enables us to step into the role that we do today. So really excited about this episode and all of the topics that we're going to cover. So I hope you enjoy it, and if you do benefit from this podcast, I do encourage you to leave a review, a rating, or subscribe. I am now updating and uploading the podcast onto YouTube, so you can access it on my YouTube channel, Highly Sensitive Humans. So welcome, Marina, and thank you so much for being on the episode today.
Hi, Jules, and thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
So I just want to start with, obviously, this podcast is all about highly sensitive people. And today I really want to ask you about your journey with being highly sensitive and how this relates to addiction and your journey with addiction and recovery and perhaps how these two relate for you.
Well, the thing is, since I was very young, and my memory goes somewhere in, around the age of six, I remember experiencing very, very often mood swings, a lot of emotional sensitivity and impulsiveness in my reactions. I also remember quite clearly that I had a really complex inner life, and I'm the only child. And I remember often I would have these imaginations, these stories in my head, and I would talk to myself when I played, and really have it, had a really vivid scenarios in my mind. Since I was young, also I was very much aware and really cautious around these subtleties of other people that are around me, especially their emotions and moods. And then I quite early started feeling pretty different and really trying hard not to be, like trying really hard to kind of blend in, right? And that was often followed with messages that I was receiving primarily from my parents, but also from the whole environment, which was, why are you so sensitive? Why are you so moody? What is wrong with you right now? Etc. So there was always, why are you like that? Dot, dot, dot. And so now, today, right, then I didn't understand what is going on. But today I actually understand how society, I mean, starting with my own family, right, is really not allowing for these difficult feelings and sensitivities. There simply kind of seemed that there's no space for that. And especially, you know, I'm talking about 80s in Serbia or Yugoslavia where I grew up. So that was like a very much a childhood. And then in terms of the addiction, I started drinking not heavily, but I started drinking very, very early, like a super early teen years. And soon enough, I stopped noticing for some reason these sensitivities. And I didn't understand what happened at that moment. I just knew that there was a moment that something clicked and that I actually felt connected, that I felt like I belong, that I'm not strange or weird in any way. And I now understand that that was actually a self-medicating, you know, that was actually changing who I really am. And all of a sudden I was outgoing and fun and not really that much conscientious, you know, and kind of resilient. And I felt these extreme feelings of excitement and joy. And, you know, considering that my drug of choice was alcohol that usually went with cocaine, I would actually, especially when mixed these two together, would actually give these intense sensations and extreme feelings. So that was the period of you know, early childhood experience, but then the drinking period. And then the third part is when I got sober, and I remember how this completely changed for me, because all of a sudden I bounced back towards, you know, being overwhelmed by outside things and a lot of people, being anxious pretty much when I have a lot of things going on. I felt like this huge need to withdraw during busy days, to be alone, to do a lot of self-care, and in order to actually just feel balanced. And I was again, I was confused, actually. I forgot all about my childhood and at that time, I was considering that not okay still. And that's when I started actually quite recently, I mean, looking into and more in depth and researching about a highly sensitive person. It became super clear to me that I absolutely am a highly sensitive person who found her way through this trait and quality through a help actually of drugs and alcohol, like many other addicts. So that's kind of where my combination of these two go.
Thank you so much for sharing about your journey. And so it's so interesting because you're describing how when you were very young, you had this sense of feeling different and, you know, being told that you were too sensitive and trying really hard not to be. And then you mentioned that it was really through alcohol that you were able to find almost a sense of belonging, and you stopped noticing your sensitivity, and it was through self-medicating that you found a way to almost, yeah, be okay with that sensitivity. And then as you became sober again, you notice yourself bouncing back and feeling that anxiety and feeling overwhelmed. So yeah, I just really appreciate you sharing how it's through the use of alcohol, and you mentioned cocaine as well, that you were able to try and handle your sensitivity. And I feel this is such a common story for so many people who do have these traits of sensitivity. And with that, I'm wondering if we could just take a moment to really define what it means to have an addiction, let's say, because we're talking about the relationship here today between sensitivity and addiction. And I know that you and I have spoken about this before, and we have spoken about Gabor Mate, who is a huge inspiration of mine, as I know he is yours, and we'll come to that more detail in a moment. So could you, yeah, perhaps define from your understanding what we mean by addiction and how that might play out?
Absolutely. And thank you for mentioning Dr. Gabor Mate. I had a privilege to study his compassionate inquiry program and become one of the practitioners. And to touch on my understanding of addiction before I joined his program, you know, before I started following him and his work, I was only familiar with something that in this field we call a medical model of addiction, you know. And in this model, addiction is basically generally seen as a disease for which there's really no known cure, and most of it it's ascribed to genetics, most often. And so I remember when I joined a 12-step program that one thing that right away kind of hit me was that this approach, this medical approach, kind of didn't really resonate with me. I always saw it pretty pessimistic, kind of negative, and in a way too definitive, too limiting for a person. But at the time, I simply didn't have a different definition, right? And as soon as I started studying with Dr. Mate, we obviously touched upon a, you know, relationship between childhood trauma and an addiction, and what is the addiction. And he says that addiction is this very complex psychophysical, so it is psychological, and it's also a physical process that manifests in any behavior. Now, that can be a substance-related behavior, or it can be any other behavior that we often call process addictions, for example, shopping, gambling, sex, internet, work. Right? So substance or processes. But the point is that in both situations, in both circumstances, a person craves this certain behavior, finds some kind of a pleasure or relief, temporary pleasure or relief in that behavior. And as much as the person suffers negative consequences as a result of it, he or she is unable to stop. And by this definition, this can apply to any behavior. So any behavior, substance related or not, that we continue doing and turning towards because it gives us a temporary pleasure or relief, basically. And this, right? I mean, this opens up so many other possibilities, and also allows in a way that, hey, maybe, you know, it can be modified. Maybe I have a certain influence and a certain part in choosing that behavior and engaging in that behavior. And with that there is a possibility of change, right? Another really important thing that I've learned through him is that addictions, they can give us a sense of control, empowerment. They can bring us more in touch with ourselves, relieve stress, offer escape from pain, And all of these are natural human needs. And as I was saying, you know, the connection with addiction and highly sensitive person, it's definitely that addiction can be a way to self-medicate and to feel more normal, quote unquote, more in peace, more relaxed, more connected. And I see that as I work with people and as I work with clients and through my own personal life, I see that, you know, the more sensitive people are, the more hurt they are. And the more hurt they are, the more they want to escape from that pain, the more they want a relief. And addiction, like many other adaptive behaviors, is a symptom of something much deeper that's underneath. It's just the adaptation to something difficult. And the question is, okay, so what's that is difficult underneath? And so that's based on Dr. Mate, that whole idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I just feel so inspired by what you just shared and his work and this idea of us moving away from this medical model of addiction being a disease. And it's the same with high sensitivity. Mm-hmm. You know, I still often get asked, oh, is being highly sensitive an illness? Is it a disease? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the answer is absolutely not. But, you know, you mentioned this idea of, you know, it being related to trauma. I believe that, you know, sensitivity is also, there's a lot of overlap with those people, mm-hmm. those of us who have experienced traumatic experiences. And then, you know, that is also highly related to, as you said, this need to escape or numb or find some kind of sense of control in terms of what we've been through and what we're experiencing. And yeah, also another thing you mentioned, which I'd like to just explore a little bit, is, you know, the subtleties of what addiction looks like. And again, I know you and I have spoken about this before in terms of, you know, often when we think about addiction, yeah, we think about those major substance mm-hmm. addictions or process addictions, like you said, in terms of alcohol, drugs, sex, and those addictions being quite explicit in a way, if that's the right word to use. But I'm interested in how, yeah, these addictions can play out in more subtle ways, and how a lot of highly sensitive people may be able to relate to these addictive behaviors, but not necessarily be able to put a label or a name to it. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
It's very interesting because I do believe, especially in the when we talk about process addictions, or let's just call them, right, not other behavioral kind of addictions, they can be really subtle. I mean, we can talk about somebody who, for example, because of the feeling of overwhelmment, for example, that is a common feeling in highly sensitive people, particularly if we don't take care of ourselves, we can, for example, turn towards emotional eating. And, you know, we don't have to have a severe problem that categorizes or diagnoses as a, or, you know, eating disorders, right? But we can be somebody who finds nourishment and peace and a sense of you know, groundedness and calming if every time that we are overwhelmed or for some reason feel triggered, we turn towards the food. And so the thing is, I remember that also what Gabor Mate says, that you know, we as children have these adaptive dynamics in us that basically they help us endure the early stress It can be early childhood trauma. It can be just a lot of stress or instability in how we live. But the thing is, if those dynamics, those behaviors become later on regular, if they become habits that we use every single time that something similar happens, they actually become toxic on their own and become problem on their own, right? And so the more you have a person that is more sensitive and more easily gets activated, let's say, if they don't take care of themselves, and a lot of high sensitive people, I mean, from my own experience, I can see that. I don't have research on this. I'm not talking from perspective of numbers, but I'm talking from personal experience and my clients and people that I see in recovery, that the most easy it is in that situation, particularly if a person is highly sensitive, to actually slip again into the addictive behavior. It's so simple, and it's such a subtle, you know, mechanism and shift that sometimes we can't even catch. And I think that me and you spoke about it last time, and when I said, I'll take a complete... you know, I'll just jump into this and say, you know, not all highly sensitive people are addicts necessarily, but I do believe that most, if not all, addicts are highly sensitive people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, like you said, perhaps you don't have the research on that. maybe it's something to be researched, but definitely from my experience as well, I would agree with you. There is a correlation there. With that, I'm wondering, would you be able to talk a bit more about what one of your biggest struggles has been as a highly sensitive person, you know, in relation to what we've just spoken about?
Absolutely. And I was just thinking about actually this as I was saying, answering the previous question. At first, I think that the biggest struggle, and this is more from the past, not something that is current, but it was accepting it. Accepting that I might be different, but I'm not weird. I'm not strange. I'm not broken. I'm not weak. I'm not emotional. There's nothing wrong with me. And this was huge. And when I was younger, and you know how usually when we're young, we just don't want to be different. We just do not want to stand out. I really felt that something is deeply wrong with me. And to that, I believe that our culture is just not approaching this trait, this highly sensitive people trait, adequately. And you mentioned it's not a disorder; it's a quality, it's a trait, it's part of, you know, personality of certain people. And I think many things can be approached differently. I almost feel that also what the society kind of is pushing onto us and forcing, you know, the competitiveness, the resiliency, the aggressiveness, the forcefulness, as well as the constantly wanting us to be happy and joyful. This messaging of being happy and being joyful is something that I really struggle with, right? Being sad, being sensitive is just not cool. It's just not cool enough. Like, it's weakness, yeah. it's softness. It's almost a sign of quitting. That's how it's actually seen. And, you know, this struggle, accepting it, I don't know what is it for you, but when I was younger, this was horrible for me. This was very difficult for me. I would be interested just to hear, like, what you think about this one, you know, for you personally.
Yeah, I relate so much. And I agree with everything you just said in terms of, you know, from my personal experience, I've had the same journey. I've always had this feeling also from when I was a very young child that there was something wrong with me, or that I was broken in some way, or yeah, I needed to change or fix myself. And the other part of this is, as you just shared, this idea that we always need to be okay, or we always need to be happy. And I just feel so strongly about the importance of, you know, us educating and sharing and letting people know that that's not the case. Like, it is okay to not be okay. It's okay to be grieving. It's okay to feel depressed. It's okay to be sensitive. And there is nothing we need to fix or get over. And there's so much power in staying with that discomfort and staying with our sensitivity. And I really believe, and this is everything I share through my work, that, you know, being sensitive is a gift. And us sensitive people have so much to offer and bring into the world. However, yeah, we feel, as you just pointed out, that we need to somehow hide it or get over it or stop being that way. Whereas I think it is the opposite. And yeah, I think we'll get to this in a moment, because I want to ask you about, again, something we've spoken about, which is this concept of the wounded, I call it the wounded healer. But before we talk more about that, I'm wondering, in terms of, you know, the struggles and this idea of knowing it's okay to be sensitive and knowing it's okay to not be okay, in the sense of having difficult emotions or difficult experiences, what's helped you on your journey of recovery, and what's helped you to learn to embrace these gifts and navigate your sensitivity?
One of the struggles that I actually recently kind of attacked, right? It was my challenge to actually learn what my needs are, to see what the needs are as a highly sensitive person, to recognize them when they appear, and then to learn how to create the proper boundaries. So this was huge in my not only recovery in my personal life, but also in my professional life, because it let me actually keep and work on those boundaries. So these same factors are actually that I need to keep in check when I work with my obsessive and compulsive tendencies or my addictions, right? They tend to show up when I don't take a proper care of myself. Like if I overschedule, if I don't get enough sleep, if I see too many clients or friends without a proper break, or engaging like negative rumination. So stopping where mindfulness really and study of yoga and Buddhism comes in a lot, which is part of my recovery, is, you know, taught me how to pause, become aware of what is going on inside of me right now, and then see, do I have to respond without getting activated and reacting? Is there something that will nourish me right now? Or maybe I can just stay in this, what's going on right now. You know, as you mentioned, actually, why do I have to fix how I feel every single time? But it helps to notice it. And that's something that, where I guess I'm kind of segueing into the what was helpful for me. So mindfulness, study of yoga and Buddhism all come into this increasing the awareness. So being more aware, being more present with everything that's going on inside of me, even when those things tend to be so, so strong. Because before, whenever it gets strong, I have the automatic default, right? The habit. I pick up the glass, or I had also moments with when I turn towards food, or when I turn towards partner or sex or intimacy or anything. So there's always these kind of things outside of me, where mindfulness and the study of yoga and Buddhism actually helped me with this a lot. Another thing where I see a great benefit is community of like-minded people, where we can feel that we belong, that we're not alone, and that we are accepted, you know, for who we are. This kind of, in a way of more replies to recovery, because I'm really not sure how much of a let's say, a support group or community exists for highly sensitive, 15 to 20% of a population, right? But for recovery, crucial is community, because it really shifts completely from what we got used to. Like, we're no longer in a habitual places, habitual people and groups. We actually have to shift to be surrounded more with those who are in a similar place like we are. Another thing that I think is really important is appropriate therapist. And I think that not every therapist knows how to work with highly sensitive people. And sometimes what I'm hearing more and more, high sensitivity can be actually, to call it, misdiagnosed with even things such as bipolar disorder, ADHD, or anxiety disorder. And if you think about these, you don't treat or approach the problem in the same way at all.
So really interesting. You've mentioned a few things there. And one is just the power of bringing awareness to your experiences and recognizing what your needs are. And with that, then being able to choose how you respond, choose how you set boundaries for yourself. And that's really come through your practice of Buddhism, yoga, and mindfulness, which I want to ask you more about in a moment, because you mentioned community as well. And definitely, I believe it relates to highly sensitive people in that we also really need community. And that's one of the reasons I set up Highly Sensitive Humans and the Highly Sensitive Hub, which is a members area where highly sensitive people can come together, and we meet twice a month online. I have lots of resources in there, and it's just a way for us to connect and support each other, because there is so much power in knowing that we're not alone. And it's that sense of belonging as well, and knowing that we have others to help us feel safe. And I think another really important aspect of that is this sense that, again, we don't need to fit into a box. We don't need to try and fit into the sense of what quote unquote normal is, but we can really just be ourselves and be vulnerable as well. So yeah, I really appreciate you mentioning the importance of community. And yeah, I'm wondering, yeah, so to go back to the Buddhism, the yoga, mindfulness, and also the compassionate inquiry you did with Dr. Gabor Mate, and I know you also run 8-week online recovery groups, which are related to Buddhism. Would you be able to share a bit more about those groups and the work that you do?
Absolutely. Those are all really useful modalities and tools. So what I guess I can just really say more about what I do, right? Because as you mentioned, I do many things, or better say, I use many different modalities and approaches. And I remember really, my whole life I was interested in so many different things that at certain times I felt, you know, yet another time incompetent, you know, because how come I don't have an exact view of what I want to do, but I'm interested in so many things and like spread thin everywhere. And so I've studied psychology and conflict resolution and mediation, and then yoga and Buddhism and meditation. And then Ayurveda and health coaching and mindfulness and compassionate inquiry, right? And then, as I mentioned, I'm also in recovery for the past, well, now it's going to be 7 years. And so how do I apply all of this? So first of all, not all of my clients are in recovering addicts. So I work with people that can come for, problems such as anxiety or wanting to explore some, trauma, or maybe there's a slight depression, or maybe there's a compulsive tendencies and they're not necessarily identifying with being an addict, right? So really, I guess I apply everything that I know, depending on the need, on the very individual need of what person wants. I work one-on-one with people, currently only online because we're in a pandemic, but I also teach groups. And currently what I do with groups is really my 8-week mindfulness-based addiction recovery course, which we shortly call MBAR, mindfulness-based addiction recovery. And since you've mentioned already 8-step recovery program, I want to say that the same person, the same woman developed two of these programs, 8-step recovery and MBAR. And her name is Valerie Mason John. And I'll make sure that we have her website included in the notes for this podcast, because I think it's a wonderful resource. So 8-week mindfulness course is basically a course open to everyone who maybe want to, you know, learn how to meditate and actually really improve their mindfulness and meditation practice, or for people who straightforward identify with a certain addiction and they need an additional support, an additional resource in how to work with their addiction, assuming that they also have other supports and that they are actually sober, so that they're actually clean in the moment when they start the program. This course has been extremely successful, and I just finished teaching two groups, and it's been just proven to be so useful and beneficial for such a different range of people. And it's filled with a lot of practical tools, meditations, mindfulness exercises, as well as certain models and dynamics and mechanisms for better understanding of addiction, relapse processes, and just the vicious cycle of it all. And so that's the 8-week course, right? The 8-step recovery program is a Buddhist approach to recovery. And it's the format of this program is very similar for two 12-step programs. And whoever is in recovery will understand, will know what I mean. This is not a course that I'm teaching. This is not something that costs a certain fee. This is my service. This is, I just facilitate the meetings and I follow the format that exists in every single 8-step recovery meeting. We have a format that we follow and we have a book. And so we read from the book, we share in the meeting, and assuming that people who identify with any addiction, that they're going to be there. So anybody, no matter what addiction they identify with, can be in that meeting. I like to say that this meeting is also open to all, but it's probably more kind of specific and geared towards people who really identify with addictions, whereas my mindfulness 8-week course can really be interesting for different people. They don't have to necessarily be in recovery from addiction. And so those are the two things that I do. So I teach the course, I facilitate the meeting once a week, and then I work one-on-one. And in that one-on-one work, I can be an Ayurvedic counselor, for example. And being an Ayurvedic counselor, Ayurveda works on teaching us a proper lifestyle, one that would allow for balance with the nature and its cycles, as well as allow for individual differences and individual needs. So sometimes people want to, you know, fix their diet, their sleeping patterns, their fatigue, for example. And, you know, then they come, for example, for Ayurveda only. If we talk about counseling or therapy, I use the combination of everything I know, but since I received a certification and education in compassionate inquiry, I actually mostly use that approach in my work. And compassionate inquiry is a really beautiful approach that no matter what background people have, we can use it to simply get the client in this presence place where they become curious as to what is going on inside of them and what is coming up. And we're basically working with the things that come up, not so much in the analysis of the mind and intellect and cognitive part, but also just on the levels of feelings, of the body sensations, and anything that actually opens up in the moment. It is a beautiful approach that really focuses on the client and their own process without me kind of stepping in as a hero helper, you know, somebody who's there to actually, you know, help a person, but more just guide and witness and offers my own presence in that process. So I think that would be kind of like on what levels and what kind of different approaches, you know, there's coaching and then there's also counseling, right? In one, I can educate people, mm-hmm. and the other one, I kind of more sit back, right? And allow clients to dig in as deep as they want to.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, as you said, it's really about the individual client or who you're working with in terms of what modality or approach right. you might adopt. And I think that's why it's so important. You know, I can relate to what you said in terms of, from my background, I've done so much training in different modalities. And I think that's crucial in terms of being able to bring them together in this very integrative approach. And drawing on what is needed for that individual person. So I think it's a real strength mm-hmm. to have many different modalities to draw upon. I was wondering, could you explain a little bit about the difference between the 12-step recovery program and the 8-step? So I understand it in terms of, you know, the 8-step is the Buddhist-inspired approach. And I'm just wondering, because I imagine a few people listening might be wondering, oh, what's the difference? Or why would I choose the 8-step recovery over the 12-step? And what would you say to that?
That's a really great question. And I have been a part of both of these programs, so I can really speak from my personal experience. 12-step recovery, so 12-step programs, original 12-step program is Alcoholics Anonymous. This program has been developed in the United States around in 20th century, around 1930s, let's say. Basically, the program was developed by two Anglo-Saxon, or let's say white Christian Americans. So the basis, the ground of this program is out of that necessarily kind of Christian. There is no necessity for one to be a Christian, to belong in any Christian church or institution in order to join this program. But what you will hear a lot about in this program is Word God. In some of the programs, the word God is exchanged with the higher power or God of your understanding. A lot of the prayers and meditations are kind of used from Christian traditions, but changed slightly. And I mean, to be honest with you, I love the program. This program was my support when I needed it most. I studied Buddhism even before I actually got clean and sober. But it wasn't until I went into 12-step program where I found a community in the middle of Los Angeles, I mean, city where you can really party and it can get really difficult to actually get clean and sober. It wasn't until then that I was actually able to stop. So I am absolutely grateful for this program. However, for me personally, being that I come from a Christianity, I was baptized when I was a kid. I come from Orthodox Christian country, but I do not resonate with Christianity. I resonate with Buddhism and much with Hinduism even. But I I was able to receive and to give back through 12-step recovery for a few years. I was very active. I was sponsoring people. I was facilitating meetings. I was really, really active. And then I hit the moment where I could not go any deeper with it. I just came to a point where I need something I will resonate more, and I will something where I will go deeper. And then I'm going to add again what I already mentioned about the medical model. That just simply didn't work for me anymore. I needed something where I can get rid of that identification of being alcoholic. I don't want to sit and repeat, I'm Marina, I'm an alcoholic. I'm Marina, I'm an alcoholic, like a mantra. I don't want that. And that's something that is a part of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can say for sure. And so 8-step recovery is not the only Buddhist approach to recovery. There is another program that is called Refuge Recovery. And I was firstly part of this program because this program was developed in Los Angeles. Now, not to go into details about any of them, but those are the Buddhist approach to recovery. Similarly to Gabor Mate's definition of addiction. In Buddhism, we also look at the addictions as if those, you know, they're outside things, situations, people, places that we attach to in order to avoid suffering and pain and actually experience joy and happiness. Isn't that addiction? I mean, that's basically it, right? I'm grasping towards whatever gives me joy or relieves my suffering, and I'm having aversion towards anything that gives me pain. That's addiction, but that's human conditioning. That's a basic human conditioning. So I'm very broadly speaking here. That's kind of, in a way, what Buddhism talks about and teaches us not to grasp for those experiences. So these programs, in particular 8-step recovery, focuses on Buddhist teachings and Buddhist principles of Buddhism that can be really useful in recovering from addictions, as well as meditations and mantras and chantings and mindfulness exercises. And to be part of this meeting or this program, you do not have to know anything about Buddhism. You do not have to identify as a Buddhist. You can also be part of both communities. Currently in my meeting that I facilitate, most people that are in my meeting are people who have been in recovery through 12-step programs for decades. And they go into both programs and they enjoy what they receive from both. So very open, very inclusive. I think this kind of sums it up. What do you think?
Yeah, no, thank you. It does. And it's really helpful. And I have to say, you know, coming from a Buddhist background myself, I wouldn't call myself a Buddhist, but I'm inspired by Buddhist philosophy, and that's what's helped me the most on my journey. And actually, Marina, I'm thinking back to, I think it's a couple of years ago now, where, because you mentioned Valerie Mason John, and she is the founder of the 8-step recovery program, right? And we're going to put her website in the show notes. And I also attended her 10-day retreat at New Life Foundation when you and I were working there. It was a few years ago now, and I can't remember the name of the retreat actually, but I just want to detox your heart. Yeah. And we went through some of the processes during that retreat, and I have to say it was, for me, one of the most transformative retreats I've ever been on. There was so much, such a need to embrace our vulnerability and, you know, using the Buddhist approaches, like you said, mindfulness and mantras, and also that sense of community that was formed within that group, within that retreat. I mean, you and I were working at the retreat center at the time. So, you know, we were coming at it from a different angle, let's say. Perhaps in both worlds of working as counselors, coaches, and being the, let's say, the client as well. But yeah, it was such a powerful experience. So I really appreciate you sharing that. And I think as well, because you mentioned the word God, and if that is, that can be a barrier for some people. I know it used to be quite a big barrier for myself in terms of, you know, hearing the word God and wondering what that even meant. So to have a support group or community where you know, we're coming at it from a different philosophy, let's say, I think that's really important. Which brings me to the question that I brought up earlier, because I just mentioned us being on the retreat and this idea of being, you know, in the role of client and then counselor and coach at the same time. So it reminds me of this concept of the wounded healer I brought up earlier. And I know, again, we spoke recently about how our personal challenges and struggles and trauma and wounds are what have enabled us to do the work we do. And, you know, we spoke about how we're on this constant journey of unfolding and healing and becoming aware of deeper layers of ourselves as we, you know, as we work to help others, we are also helping and healing ourselves. And this is something I feel so passionate about, because I really also want to move away from this myth that just because, let's say, we're working in this helping profession, that we are healed and that we've got it all figured out.
Sure.
I wish that was the case. Oh, yeah. But I was just wondering, yeah, how do you relate to this? And yeah, again, why do you think this is so important for us to talk about?
I love it. I mean, wounded warrior or wounded healer is so significant to all of us, right? In this, in whoever is doing people work or any kind of healing, because we are all wounded healers. And to be quite honest, that's one of the main reasons why we chose to do what we do, right? Sure, there is the desire to alleviate the suffering of others, but I mean, we actually, because of we are wounded, we got motivated. Something in us sparked this idea. I remember when I started psychology, one of my first classes in the undergraduate program, they asked us, like, why are we here? Why are we studying psychology? And I remember most of us, you know, raising hands and saying, oh, because I want to help others and I want to help people. And I'm thinking, you know what? I want to understand the workings of my own mind and my behaviors. I first want to figure this thing out, me. And obviously, yes, I want to alleviate the suffering of others. I have to say, though, that we don't need to be perfect. We don't need to finish this path of healing. If you ask me, recovery in general, not from addiction, but any recovery, any growth, transformation, any change, it's all part of life. It's to me, it's like it's a never-ending process, not in the way that I want to self-improve. Not in a way that I want to be violent and aggressive towards myself and never be satisfied with myself, but yes, in the way that I always want to learn more and figure out new ways and see how more in depth I can go. So in that way, for me, this my own personal path is never going to end. It's never going to stop. But we have to be careful about one thing. We actually have to work out our own issues, or we have to be working out our own issues as we work with others. We have to figure out where we are wounded. Otherwise, we can easily go and hurt others without even knowing. So it's essential to recognize our own woundedness. Knowing what happened to me, I have to know what happened to me. I have to understand it. I have to own it. And then I have to take responsibility and move from it, grow from it, and transform from it and change. Because otherwise, Otherwise, I can actually be asking myself, am I helping from the wound place or am I helping from authentic place? Is this me, you know, helping because, you know, in the past, when I was a child, I learned that I have to be there for everybody. Otherwise, I'm not a good person. And that's my underlying belief about myself, that I'm a piece of shit, that actually, unless I'm doing things for others, I won't be noticed or acknowledged. Or am I actually helping from authentic place, from this healthy place where I am present to guide others to process, but I'm not attaching myself and I'm not seeing myself responsible for how far they go because it's their process. And in that sense, I think, you know, we have to understand where our wound is, be okay with it, but we can't be blind to what our stuff is. I gotta know what's mine. And I have to be figuring out what to do with it. Otherwise, I can actually hurt people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I really appreciate you saying that. And, you know, you said that question, am I helping from the wounded place or the authentic self? And I think that's so powerful and important that we need to ask ourselves that. And in fact, I feel everyone needs to ask that question, whether we're working in a helping profession or not, just as we go around about in our day-to-day lives, you know, just asking, where are my choices coming from? Why am I doing this? What part of me is being activated right now? And I think another thing you said, which really resonated with me, was this sense of, yeah, we're not trying to, because I fell into this trap before, when I started this journey, I was on this constant search to improve and fix myself. That's how it felt when I was younger. How do I make myself okay? How do I, going back to what we said earlier, how do I get over this? How do I become healed and perfect, you know, striving for that perfection? And it's really been a long journey for me to, and I'm still on this journey, but, you know, just realizing that I'm never going to be healed. I'm never going to be perfect. And actually, there's so much power in just embracing our imperfections and embracing our wounds and knowing it is those wounds that drive us. And for me, the wounds, the trauma, the parts of me that have been broken are what drive me forward. And I'm not trying to get rid of them. I'm trying to hold space for them. So, such an important concept and message.
I have to completely say, I completely relate with you. You know, first of all, I was thinking that I am not perfect and I waited for a long time. I always do. Whenever I finish a certain process of my own or a certain educational, you know, certification or a program, I actually get very conscientious and doubtful if I'm ready to teach it, if I'm ready to share it. And there's always this uncertainty because I think I have to be in this place of perfection and I cannot mess up. And what are others going to think if I, God forbid, say something, but then I don't act it completely? Sure, I have to walk my talk, right? And not preach, but rather be put myself down on earth, right? And just simply walk side by side with others and share my experience. That's how I see it. But there was a time when I was younger, when I was more doubtful, when I felt more incompetent, in times when I'm not fully balanced, I tend to slide into these places and to wonder sometimes, am I fake? Am I a phony in this process? You know, how is it that sometimes I act out still on certain things, you know? What would people think if they would see me or hear my thoughts? And honestly, the only things that helped me then is compassion. It's compassion. I'm a human being. I'm a human being. One thing that I love about it is that never again will this thing, this doubt, this rumination, never again it will go unnoticed. because I know now better. I know what to look for. I know how to notice it. I know how to sense it, how to take care of myself and know when I'm not okay, when I'm not well, when something's going on. And that's huge. That's huge, right? We're not perfect, but hey, I'm so much more in touch with who I am. And I notice things.
Yeah, that is huge. And again, that reminds me of this idea that the, let's say, because we're talking about the sense of being an imposter or, yeah, thinking we're a fraud or that all of those doubts and fears that comes up for me as well. And I actually don't know anyone who doesn't experience that in some way, shape or form. But the amazing thing what you're saying is actually perhaps it never goes away fully. But we can be aware of it and then choose how we respond to that, right? And that's the power of compassion and mindfulness and being present with ourselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering, to kind of wrap things up a bit, because we are coming close to the end, do you have a favorite book or quote or something you'd like to share for our listeners today?
Oh, wow. I know that people usually ask this in podcasts, and I have such a hard time remembering like one thing or one book or, you know, but I do want to say that I very, very strongly recommend to people Gabor Mate's book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. Absolutely. And I think that book is brilliant on so many levels. The hungry ghost concept is basically in Buddhism, like a symbol from Buddhism that basically is addiction. These are these mythical creatures with like small mouth and narrow necks and big bellies that can never get enough, which is kind of symbolically what addiction is. And it's a beautiful, amazing book that has a personal story as an example, as well as some of his theory and his thoughts about it, and very readable for like lay people, not only those who are working in addiction and recovery field. So that would be one of the addiction particular. And I have to say Pema Chodron's book, When Things Fall Apart, just because I go through books and then I constantly go back to some quote from that book or from something that I heard there. And for those who don't know, Pema Chodron is one of the Western Buddhist teachers and nuns that is really, really brilliant, and many, many books that are all amazing. But When Things Fall Apart is my favorite. So maybe too much kind of a classic thing, but I'll leave it there. And in terms of the quote, I gotta tell you, I just recently listened to a podcast where this brilliant therapist, who's also a highly sensitive person, where she was actually on the podcast that I can also give you that as a resource. It's a brilliant podcast for women particularly. And I read her quote about highly sensitive people. Very brief. You're not too sensitive. You're exquisitely perceptive. I love it. You're not too sensitive. You're exquisitely perceptive.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
It helped me a lot. It kind of switched it right away from this kind of like a weak place to this empowered and amazing strength, actually. For me, at least, that happened when I read it.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And also the books, interestingly, I have In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts right in front of me in this very moment, because I knew we were going to be talking about Gabor Mate today. And I love that book. And also another one of his books, which is a favorite of mine, is Scattered Mind or Scattered Minds.
Yes.
Where he talks about ADD and ADHD. And that's a whole different topic. But again, I just love how he moves away from the medical model in terms of talking about ADD and ADHD and relates it to trauma. And I think many highly sensitive people will relate to that as well. So thank you for sharing those. And then Pema Chodron, When Things Fall Apart, I go to that book all the time as well. I remember reading it quite a few years ago when I was going through quite a difficult time and just found it so helpful. So yeah, I also would recommend that book. So I'll put those links in the show notes for everyone. And yeah, is there anything else you want to share today as we come to the end now?
I want to share that I think that what kept me in this place of constantly wanting to continue not only growing myself but doing what I do is seeing possibility and capacity of all humans to change and to transform. And honestly, through recovery and even through 12-step programs and communities, I've seen and I've witnessed stories of people that if I'd heard those stories years ago before I started my process of recovery, I would not think that those people would stand a chance in the world. Mm-hmm. And seeing the ability of people and capacity of people, every single one, to change their point of view, to change their reality, to actually, you know, move from the space of victimhood and the place where we have to live, you know, from the places that happened to us in the past, to this new place. So like, okay, I can't change that, but I can relate differently to it. That is something that really is amazing. And I think for us who are highly sensitive, living deeply can mean that we feel things a lot, and they can often leave us, you know, feeling depleted and fragile, and like everything we do is wrong and like we're drowning. But the thing is, we have to remember that we also feel more delight. We feel more meaning. We feel more joy, and we see and get more from beauty. And every time I personally forget, you know, and I turn towards the downfalls of the being a highly sensitive person, I have to remember also of the other side of the coin. And I think that's really important and something that we should not stop repeating and getting reminders of. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And I think that's such a great point to finish on. Reminder that there is that potential there, and we can always heal and reach our other side. So I really appreciate you sharing that. And thank you so much for being on the podcast today. It's been amazing to talk to you about all of this.
Thank you so much, Jules, for having me. I really, honestly, when I say I feel honored, I love this. I love because it allowed me actually to also dive deep more into myself and my personal story, and also relate to my clients. It's been lovely being
Brilliant.
Here.
Brilliant. And I will put all of the links to your website and all of the resources we've mentioned today in the show notes, so that'll be accessible for everyone. So thanks again.
Thanks for joining me this week on Highly Sensitive Humans. Make sure to visit my website, highlysensitivehumans.com, where you can subscribe to my mail list for regular updates, or join the Highly Sensitive Hub, which is a membership area and growing community for highly sensitive people. In the membership area, I share monthly bundles of resources, tools, meditations, and we have a community forum and monthly workshops for us to get together and support each other on our journey. And if you found value in the show, I'd really appreciate a rating and review. And please share this episode with your friends or other highly sensitive people that will find this podcast helpful.